Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the May issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Matthew McConaughey. The Oscar-winning actor gets deeply personal about his memories as a son and a father in the memoir Green Lights. He sits down with CNI to talk about the process of writing it and how he compares to his own late dad as a parent. By Joe Layden. For Matthew McConaughey, Green Lights is more than just the title of his hugely entertaining and remarkably revealing memoir. It's also a way of life for the Oscar-winning actor, famed for his eagerness to just keep living. Green lights, he explains early in his book, are affirmations of our way. They're approvals, support, praise, gifts, gas on our fire, attaboys and appetites. We have green lights. They don't interfere with our direction. They're easy. They're a shoeless summer. They say yes and give us what we want. On the other hand, green lights can be disguised as yellow and red lights, a caution, a detour, a thoughtful pause, an interruption, a disagreement, indigestion, sickness, and pain. We don't like yellow and red lights. They slow us down or stop our flow. They're hard. They're a shoeless winter. They say no, but sometimes give us what we need. Drawn heavily from journals and mementos that McConaughey, now 51, has maintained for decades, Green Lights takes us down the long and winding road that started in his birthplace of Uvalde, Texas, reached a major turning point in Austin, where he made his big screen breakthrough in Dazed and Confused in 1993 as Wooderson, the role that enabled him to improvise his trademark, "All right, all right, all right," and continues here and there to movie and television locations throughout the globe. Just as important, indeed arguably more important, Green Lights focuses on McConaughey's defining relationships with his parents, James Donald McConaughey and Mary Kathleen McCabe, a couple given to raucous quarrels and passionate reconciliations. As Wikipedia tactfully notes, they married each other three times, having divorced each other twice. Later sections of the book are devoted to the actor's current life in Austin with his wife, Camila Alves, and their three children, ranging in ages 8 to 12. On a recent early spring afternoon, McConaughey agreed to Zoom in from the sunlit patio of his Austin home base to talk about his book, his career, and his roles as son and father. What follows are highlights from our conversation, edited for brevity and clarity. CNI. Early in Green Lights, you remark, "I never wrote things down to remember. I wrote things down so I could forget." When you were reviewing decades of notes and journals to write Green Lights, what did you come across that made you feel, "Yeah, I really wanted to forget that"? McConaughey. Well, going back and writing a book based on the last 50 years of my life, that was already an intimidating idea. I was like, I'm going to go back and I'm going to see things where I'm embarrassed, where I feel shame, where I feel guilt. I'm going to see things where I was an arrogant little know-it-all prick, and I'm not going to like it. And I did see all those things. But most of the things I was embarrassed about, I ended up laughing at. Most things I felt ashamed or guilty about, I had either forgiven myself for or forgave myself for. And then, whenever I saw myself as an arrogant little prick in my life at times, I noticed that each time, soon after, I got humiliated and humbled, and I was all of a sudden like, well, if you wouldn't have been the arrogant prick, you might not have had the confidence to put yourself in that position to get you humbled. I've actually got to say I enjoyed going back through that year in Australia. While I was in it, I was like, whoa, when's this going to be over? But I've got enough room and distance in my life from then that I know if that wouldn't have happened, if I wouldn't have had that year, I don't think I'd be sitting here talking to you about the life I've got so far. CNI, no regrets? Well, there were a lot of red lights that I looked at, like lying to my dad. I still wish I wouldn't have done that. And that pizza story. I felt ashamed about that for a long time and wished I was man enough to just own up and tell him the truth. Because the lesson on that one, kiddos, if you read the book, is if you stole a pizza tonight for dinner and you get home when your dad's up and he asks, did you pay for that pizza? It means he knows you didn't. So don't lie about it. But I tried to weasel my way out of it. So that'd probably be the one thing I still regret the most, because I remember seeing the pain and anguish on his face, of his feeling like he was failing as a father if he had a son who sat there and lied to him 4 times to his face. In your book, you write that years later, when you called your father to tell him you were switching your major from law to film at the University of Texas, you were surprised and relieved by his unconditional encouragement. Do you think you might have hesitated to make that fateful move had he disapproved? That's a great question, because one of the things that I've noticed while looking back was, let's say that conversation took 15 seconds. I call, hey, Pop, what are you doing, monkey man? I want to talk to you about something. Yeah, what's that, buddy? I don't want to go to law school anymore. I want to go to film school. Pause. Are you sure that's what you want to do? Yes, sir. I immediately come back and say, pause. Well, don't half-ass it. Now, however long that just was, 15 or 20 seconds, part of the reason I believe he said, don't half-ass it, is he heard in my voice that I really wasn't asking his permission. He heard the conviction in my voice that I wouldn't go on. I didn't say, well, I think maybe it'd be cool if I went to film school, and I think that's what I want to do. I think if I would have stuttered, or if he'd been able to tell that I hadn't given it my own thought and hadn't really put time into it for myself to make that decision, I think he would have said, well, that sounds great, boy, but you can do that on Saturdays. You're going to have to get a real job. You ain't doing that. I ain't paying for that. But I think he heard in my voice that I really wasn't asking him permission. And he heard in my voice that I wasn't bluffing when I proposed it to him. CNI. So that was a major turning point for both of you. Carnegie. One of the things I think any parent wants is to raise their children to learn how to block and tackle and stay in your lane. There are rules and regulations, but one of the proudest days is when your child decides they're going out of the category you gave them and going their own way. And they come to you and say, this is what I'm doing. I'm not asking permission. I think in that moment, on that phone call, my dad heard my voice and was inside going, yes, I have succeeded as a father because I helped raise a son that's confident enough to come to me and go, Dad, I know what I want to do, and I'm going to do it. I can't imagine him saying anything else now. Again, if I'd stuttered and said, I think, well, I mean, maybe it's a good idea, I don't know what he would have said. He wouldn't have said, don't half-ass it. He'd probably at least said, I want you to think on it some more, son, because I'm not quite hearing you. I'm not hearing a son that's convinced himself yet. But he heard in my voice that he had a son that had convinced himself. CNI. Decades ago, I interviewed Michael Caine, who told me that at the time his father was dying, the old guy really thought of his son as a failure, a struggling actor who couldn't find work and wouldn't be able to take care of his widowed mom. And Caine practically had tears in his eyes when he said, "You never get over that. You were blessed to not have that problem. You were already days into filming Dazed and Confused, which would be your breakthrough film, when he passed away. He not only was not ashamed of you or think you were a failure, he was expecting big things from you in your field, right?" I think so. Look, I've always seen that as a state of grace. The fact that my father was alive, that his life here and my life as an actor overlapped. He lived 5 days into my starting what would be more than a fad, what became a career. And that's the first thing in my life that I got to start that wasn't a fad. I remember one summer when I was younger asking him, "I want a skateboard. Can I get the elbow pads and the knee pads?" "Well, I don't know, son. Money's tight. Are you sure you want to?" "Dad, I promise you, I really want to do this. I'm going to practice and everything." Shit, I practiced for about 2 months and quit. It was a fad. I always felt like, damn it, you really talked Dad into buying you those elbow pads and knee pads, but you didn't really commit to that. So for him to be alive for the first time that his son started something that would not turn out to be a fad, to me, there's grace and serendipity in that. I don't mean he thought anything like, "Oh, now I've got my final son off doing what he's doing. Now I can pass away." I don't think that those two things were related. But I do go, in hindsight, "Oh, that's really graceful that that happened, that his life overlapped with me starting what would become a career." In Green Lights, you mention your immediate reaction after your father passed away. It was time to trade in any red sports car I still had. It was time to stop dreaming and start dealing. It was time for me to take care of Mom. It was time for me to take care of myself. It was time to sober up from boyhood whimsy. It was time for me to get real courage. It was time for me to become a man. What did being a man mean for you then, and what do you think it means for you now? Well, then it meant maybe I was only giving 80% because I had a safety net, my dad. I had a crutch if I really needed it, my dad. Well, he moved on, and that wonderful, abominable snowman of a man who I didn't think could die was physically no longer here anymore. And I was like, "You ain't got nobody to catch your back when you fall now. You don't have that crutch anymore. You don't have that man to rely on, so you better take ownership of what you've been kind of half-assing, Matthew, and have courage to become that man, because you can't be relying on your old man having your back anymore, because he ain't here." And now? I know more of what I'm about now and who I am and where I want to go then than I did then. Back then, I was still in the middle of early years of defining what I was not, who I did not want to be. A process of elimination leading me towards where I am now. I have a vision of where I want to go and why I'm still working on the how, but I'm much more affirmative now. I'm not just getting rid of things I don't want. How often do you find yourself talking to your three children and suddenly realize you hear your father's voice in yours? Quite often. I engage with my children, and I know I explain a lot more than my dad explained to me. My dad was more like, "This is what you do. I'll give you some reasons why, but after that, if you don't understand it, it's because I said so. That's it. And there's great value in that. But I'll go past that. I've chosen to engage with them when they ask why. I'll be like, well, let me help you understand it more." I probably over-explained some and probably could have used that "because I said so" a few times, but I'm trying to give my kids the chance to understand, and me the chance to contextualize it, and then challenging myself as a communicator and storyteller to go, wait, how can I give this lesson where an 8-year-old understands it? Do they ask many questions about what their father does for a living? The two oldest, I think, get it pretty completely now. The youngest, maybe not so much. And mind you, they haven't been able to see 90% of my movies. They're not appropriate for them yet. When you see those, that's going to open up a whole nother bunch of sit-downs. That's the reason I started doing voiceovers in some animated movies and TV shows, because I got tired of hearing the question of, what's your kid's favorites of all the stuff you've done? You know what I mean? So you think you'll be a while before you show them, say, Dallas Buyers Club or Magic Mike or Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation? We might want to give those a few more months, don't you think? Green Lights is available wherever books are sold. For an added treat, check out the McConaughey narrated audiobook version. A podcast version of the Hank the Cowdog series is also available on all podcast platforms, featuring the actor voicing Hank. Just keep working. McConaughey wears many hats for the likes of the University of Texas, Wild Turkey, and Lincoln. Will Texas native and resident Matthew McConaughey launch a campaign to become governor of the Lone Star State? It's a true consideration, he diplomatically replied when asked the question in March during the Balanced Voice podcast hosted by Rania Macarius. This teasing acknowledgement of gubernatorial ambitions came in stark contrast to many of the Oscar-winning actor's previous remarks regarding politics. When asked a similar question last November by Late Show host Stephen Colbert, McConaughey demurred, "Right now, no, I don't get politics. Politics seems to be a broken business. Politics needs to redefine its purpose." On the other hand, he kind of sort of left the door open when he told radio talk show host Hugh Hewitt that when politics redefines its purpose, I could be a hell of a lot more interested. Of course, finding time for politicking might prove challenging even for an indefatigable multitasker like McConaughey. Consider his current crowded schedule. When he isn't doing commercial voiceover work for Reliant Energy and appearing in ads for Lincoln Automobiles, he is a creative director for Wild Turkey and co-creator of that company's Long Branch bourbon brand. He also is part owner of the Austin FC Soccer Club and Minister of Culture for the soon-to-open multi-million-dollar basketball arena and live performance center at Austin's University of Texas, where, not incidentally, he has taught film courses at the Department of Radio, Television, Film since 2015. More recently, McConaughey has been the prime mover behind We're Texas, a virtual benefit concert aimed at helping residents in the state whose homes were damaged and lives disrupted during February's devastating winter storm. He himself weathered that storm with relatively little stress, enduring only a brief stretch without electricity and some busted water pipes at his Austin home. But he was quick to note the needs of fellow Texans who were far less lucky. I called over 50 Texas artists and musicians, he said during the Balanced Voice podcast, and everybody within the first 30 seconds of my asking said, whatever you want me to do, yes. And on top of all that, well, there are his time-consuming twin careers as actor and voiceover artist to consider, to say nothing of what he considers his most important role, father for Livingston, Vida, and Levi. I have three epics in my life, he told Mancarius, and that's my three children. That's the greatest light or shadow that wife Camilla, Alves, and I can leave. the greatest shadow I can leave as a father. Of course, some people do enter politics to help make the world better for their kids. Stay tuned for further developments. The CNI lightning round. Near the end of our conversation, we asked McConaughey if we could toss a few random names his way, and he would respond with the first word or memory that popped into his head. He agreed and took the plate while we manned the pitcher's mound. Joel Schumacher, director of A Time to Kill, 1996. Sexy, like, Joel, tell me one thing all your films are about. Oh, that's easy, honey. Turned around to the chalkboard with a piece of chalk and a big sweeping motion. He goes, S-E-X-Y, and laughs. And he told me great things. I mean, early on he said, hey, there's no help wanted signs in Hollywood. The guards at the gates are not there to keep you in. They're there to keep you out. Bill Murray, star of Larger Than Life, 1996. And Enigma. Talk about a guy who has a completely original and specific frequency that nobody else has. And just when you think you got his frequency, he'll throw something off that's a different frequency. He's an enigma that way. Martin Scorsese, director of The Wolf of Wall Street, 2013. Funny. Loves funny. One of the great things to see as an actor is Martin Scorsese's shoulders bouncing up and down while he's laughing when he's looking at the monitor watching playback of the scene you just did. He loves funny. Samuel L. Jackson, co-star of A Time to Kill, 1996. Hardest working man in Hollywood. Samuel, he's a no-frills guy. No frills. He's like, hey, there it is. Let's make this simple. And the answer is yes. He's affirmative and yeah, no frills. Donald Sutherland, co-star of A Time to Kill, 1996. Let's talk presence right there. That man never intrudes. But from his eyes to his heels to his haunches, he is extremely present and draws you in like a moth to a light bulb. Trace Atkins, co-star of The Lincoln Lawyer, 2011. Gentleman. Michael Douglas, co-star of Ghosts of Girlfriends Past, 2009. Class. Renee Zellweger, star of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, 1994. Hippie chick. Jodie Foster, star of Contact, 1997. Deliberate. James Donald McConaughey, Pop. That's Pop, P-O-P. Mary Kathleen McCabe, Mom. Yes, her favorite word. She is 89 and doing great. Part of the reason she's so sharp and so healthy is because throughout life she has consistently taken the path of most resistance. Like she told me, don't walk into the place like you want to buy it. Walk in like you own it.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading articles from True West Magazine. June 2021. Remembering Larry McMurtry by Johnny D. Boggs. The life and times of the legendary Western writer and the legacy of Lonesome Dove. Quote, sometimes Sonny felt like he was the only human creature in town. Those were the first words I ever read written by Larry McMurtry, who died March 25th at age 84. They certainly weren't the last. In 1984, as a young reporter at the Dallas Times-Herald and a Texas transplant from South Carolina, McMurtry was required reading, so I devoured The Last Picture Show, Leaving Cheyenne, and Horseman Pass By, his first three novels, in my apartment. Back then, McMurtry was known for wearing a sweatshirt that identified him as a minor regional novelist. Regional? Yes. Minor? Debatable. Not many minor writers see their first three novels turned into motion pictures. But McMurtry was what Pat Conroy was to South Carolina, and what Max Evans and Tony Hillerman were to New Mexico, a regional writer who attracted readers outside his region. McMurtry wrote about the 20th century West, sometimes putting contemporary cowboys in urban settings, as in Cadillac Jack, 1982, about a bulldogger turned antique scout in Washington, D.C., and often skipping cowboys altogether. Somebody's Darling, 1978, chronicled a woman director in Hollywood. In one interview, McMurtry said Western writers should give up the mythical frontier and focus on the modern West. Ironically, when I read that quote, McMurtry had to have been writing what would become his masterpiece. In 1985, Simon & Schuster published Lonesome Dove, an 843-page novel about an 1870s cattle drive from Texas to Montana. But McMurtry's story began much earlier. Peter Bogdanovich, who had directed The Last Picture Show, 1971, and McMurtry planned a period Western movie, Streets of Laredo, that would star John Wayne, James Stewart, and Henry Fonda. They were to be old cowboys that had tumbled into their last adventure, McMurtry told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram in 1987. When their adventure was over, the West was over. On his way to a steakhouse, McMurtry passed a school bus on the side of the road. Painted on the bus's side was Lonesome Dove Baptist Church. "I knew Lonesome Dove would make a great title," McMurtry said in that 1987 Star-Telegram profile. "5 years passed before I put the name on the bus with the story in the screenplay and wrote Lonesome Dove." When Streets of Laredo never got out of development, McMurtry bought back the rights and started writing the novel, pecking away at it when he found time while focusing on Cadillac Jack and The Desert Rose, 1983. He set out to trash the myth of the cowboy. Readers took his tale entirely differently. Lonesome Dove sales skyrocketed. It won the Spur Award from the Western Writers of America and the Pulitzer Prize, and was adapted into an equally successful CBS miniseries in 1989. It wasn't that publishers had shunned literary fiction set on the American frontier before Lonesome Dove. Douglas C. Jones, The Court Martial of George Armstrong Custer, 1976, Brian Garfield's Wild Times, 1978, Lucia St. Clair Robeson's Ride the Wind, 1982, Ron Hansen's The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, 1983, and Ivan Duig's English Creek, 1984, were success stories, but Lonesome Dove took success to an entirely new level for Western fiction. Other well-received novels, Gary Matthews' Heart of the Country, 1986, Pete Dexter's Deadwood, 1986, Elmer Kelton's The Man Who Rode Midnight, 1987, Glendon Swarthout's The Horseman, 1988, Jane Candia Coleman's Doc Holliday's Woman, 1995, followed. McMurtry also opened the doors for many new young writers of the American West. None came close to matching Lonesome Dove's landmarks. "Now it seems to be replacing Gone with the Wind as a national epic," McMurtry told the Los Angeles Times in 1989. The Texas ranch kid who once said 20th century writers should not write about the 19th century began producing more westerns set in the 1800s, including Lonesome Dove's sequels and prequels, Streets of Laredo, 1993, Dead Man's Walk, 1995, and Comanche Moon, 1997. Lonesome Dove also made McMurtry a captive, as he told the Arizona Republic in 1995. When The Late Child was published that year, McMurtry said, "I like it a lot, but I suspect it's going to be treated like a little orphan book slipped in and around Lonesome Dove books." McMurtry's other period novels hit the bookshelves. Anything for Billy, 1988, Buffalo Girls, 1990. Zeke and Ned, 1997. Boone's Lick, 2000. And his Berry Bender series about a troubled 1830s hunting expedition. Sin Killer, 2002. The Wandering Hill, 2003. By Sorrow's River, 2003. Folly and Glory, 2004. Not all captivated critics. While most of us never read McMurtry expecting historical accuracy, just mesmerizing prose, McMurtry's treatment of history and the Cherokees in Zeke and Ned enraged a number of high-profile and well-respected Western novelists, including Cherokee Robert J. Conley and best-selling Don Coldsmith, the latter saying that many Cherokees refused to speak McMurtry's name after Zeke and Ned. McMurtry's fiction began getting mediocre reviews, and sometimes not even that. If you're looking for another Lonesome Dove, the Des Moines Register said of By Sorrow's River, you'll be disappointed. McMurtry has tipped away from realism and the concrete into the cartoonishly absurd, the Austin American Statesman said of Folly and Glory. Perhaps McMurtry thought the same. Eventually, all novelists, if they persist too long, get worse, McMurtry wrote in Books, a Memoir. No reason to name names, since no one is spared. But McMurtry kept producing at a Louis L'Amour pace, not just fiction, but nonfiction. While Crazy Horse, 1999, garnered good reviews, other titles were ripped. You'd think that Lonesome Dove creator McMurtry would add a big dose of Western sensibility to his account of the Wild West shows. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette wrote of The Colonel and Little Missy, Buffalo Bill, Annie Oakley, and the Beginnings of Superstardom in America, 2005. But his efforts proved little more than a superficial glossing of Cody's life. Distinguished Texas writer Brian Woolley wrote for the Dallas Morning News that McMurtry's Oh, What a Lovely Slaughter, 2006, doesn't carry the reader much beyond generalization, and its language is devoid of grace or power. Yet McMurtry did what writers are supposed to do. He wrote a lot, often 2 to 3 books in a year. And while his fiction and historical nonfiction were often sloppy, his memoirs, Walter Benjamin at the Dairy Queen, Reflections at 60 and Beyond, 1999, Roads, Driving America's Great Highways, 2000, Books, a Memoir, 2008, Literary Life, a Second Memoir, 2009, and Hollywood, a Third Memoir, 2010, earned raves. He and writing partner Diana Ossana also won the Academy Award for adapting Prolix's short story Brokeback Mountain into director Ang Lee's 2000 film, which collected 2 other Oscars and was nominated for 5 more. Because of when and where I grew up on the Great Plains, just as the herding tradition was beginning to lose its vitality, I have been interested all my life in vanishing breeds, McMurtry said. McMurtry was a vanishing breed himself. Live through it, Woodrow Call says in Lonesome Dove. That's all we can do. That could be McMurtry's epitaph. He might always be remembered for one novel, but his legacy goes beyond Lonesome Dove. For even in his worst books, McMurtry could still turn that perfect sentence that most of us could never dream of writing. And in his best works, well, here's another fitting epitaph for Larry McMurtry, June 13, 1936, to March 25, 2021, spoken by the Mexican cook Poe Campo in What Else, Lonesome Dove. Quote, I sing about life. I am happy, but life is sad. Johnny D. Boggs' favorite Larry McMurtry line comes from In a Narrow Grave. Quote, only a rank degenerate would drive 1,500 miles across Texas without eating a chicken fried steak. True West, April 2021. Tracking the Texas Rangers by Mike Cox. Follow the historic trails of the Lone Star Lawmen through West Texas from San Angelo to El Paso. They are having a lively time in Tom Green County, reported the March 24, 1877 Daily Fort Worth Standard. 6 murders in 3 months and no arrests. Beyond the violence in and around San Angelo, organized bands of stock thieves exist in such numbers, and the county is so sparsely settled that the laws cannot be enforced. However, help was coming. The citizens and officers for the county have forwarded a petition to Austin to have the state send rangers to aid the civil authorities. Peaceful compared to frontier times, modern San Angelo makes a great starting place for Old West history buffs hankering to saddle up and back trail the early Texas Rangers across West Texas. Old Fort Concho, now a National Historic Site, is one of the West's best-preserved frontier forts. Downtown, colorful murals depict the city's history, and in the lobby of the public library is a life-sized statue of the late Western writer Elmer Kelton. Several of his best-selling novels featured the Rangers. From San Angelo, head west on U.S. 67, which goes all the way to Presidio, but there are some historic places to visit before you get there. West to Fort Stockton and Pecos. 165 miles southwest of San Angelo on U.S. 67 is Fort Stockton, named for the old military post standing near the once prolific Comanche Springs. The Army chose the spot because it was a watering hole along the Great Comanche War Trail. Hostile Indians were long gone by 1894, but law and order remained a work in progress. Someone shotgunned lame duck Sheriff A.J. Royal on November 21st. No arrests were made in the killing, and there were even dark rumors that a ranger may have had a hand in it. The assassination took place inside the 1883 vintage Pecos County Courthouse, 400 South Nelson Street. The desk where Royal sat when he was killed is at the Annie Riggs Museum, 301 South Main Street. A museum dedicated to the history of the military post is in Barracks No. 1, Old Fort Stockton. After you've tamed Fort Stockton, the next stop on your ranger channeling journey is Pecos, 54 miles away via U.S. 285. Just west of the river that gave the railroad and ranching town its name, Pecos claims to have staged the West's first rodeo. While that's debatable, so far as is known, no one has ever been killed over it. During the 1880s and 90s, however, Pecos denizens had no trouble finding other reasons to shoot. Take former Ranger George Alexander Frazier and Jim Deacon Miller, a devout Methodist who neither smoked nor drank but ignored the sixth commandment, the one about not killing. Frazier had served as Reeves County Sheriff with Miller as his deputy, but they had a falling out. On April 12, 1894, 6 months after losing a re-election bid, Frazier confronted Miller in Pecos. Accurately calling him out as a cow thief and murderer, Frazier shot Miller in the arm and then put several bullets in his chest. Or so he thought. Unknown to Frazier, the deacon wore metal body armor. Though badly bruised, he recovered. More than 2 years later, on September 13, 1896, Miller found Frazier in a Toya saloon and permanently settled the score with his double-barreled shotgun. A jury acquitted him, but his luck played out in 1909 when a lynch mob in Ada, Oklahoma, adjudicated him without possibility of appeal. Since 1962, the former Orient Hotel and No. 11 Saloon at 120 East Dot Stafford Street has been the home to the west of the Pecos Museum. Bullet holes from a gunfight in the saloon are still visible. Southwest to Alpine. Alpine, 67 miles further west on U.S. 67, began as a stop on the Southern Pacific. Given the vastness of the Trans-Pecos, which covers 31,479 square miles and is larger than any one of 10 U.S. states, the railroad made the mountain-circled town particularly important for the Rangers. In mid-1890, Company D Ranger, Captain Frank Jones, made Alpine his headquarters. From there, with their horses loaded on a stock car, Rangers could travel by train as far as possible and continue to the latest trouble spot in the more traditional ray. Today, Amtrak serves Alpine. You can immerse yourself in the region's rich history at the Museum of the Big Bend. Founded in 1925, the museum is on the Sul Ross State University campus. Alpine is the closest community of any size to history-rich Big Bend, a vast expanse where old-time Rangers did much business. One of them, Everett Ewing Townsend, became enthralled with the rugged mountains and canyons along the Big Bend of the Rio Grande. Later, as a state legislator and then a private citizen, he played an important role in promoting development of Big Bend National Park. The longtime lawman is buried in Alpine's Elm Grove Cemetery. Fort Davis, Marfa, and Presidio. From Alpine, travel 24 miles on South Highway 118 to the mile-high town of Fort Davis, named after the army post that guarded the Trans-Pecos from 1854 to 1891. The Rangers had a camp nearby from which they chased hostile Indians and outlaws. That site is privately owned, but you can immerse yourself in the area's history at the Fort Davis National Historic Site. Another Ranger-related site is the Overland Trail Museum, located in the former home of colorful barber and justice of the peace, Nick Mersfelder. The pipe-smoking German came to Fort Davis as a Ranger in 1881 and never left. It's only 21 miles from Fort Davis to Marfa, where you can pay your respects to one of the better-known chroniclers of Ranger history, James B. Gillett. Beyond his contributions to the peace and dignity of the state as a Ranger, he wrote a classic, 6 Years with the Texas Rangers. He's buried in Marfa Cemetery, 210 West San Antonio Street, U.S. 90. Also, check out the Marfa and Presidio County Museum, 110 West San Antonio Street, and the old, 1886, Presidio County Jail, 310 Highland Street. From Marfa, head down to the old border town of Presidio. On the way, check out the once-thriving silver mining town of Shafter, 40 miles south on U.S. 67. Ranger John Gravis and a deputy sheriff were policing Shafter the night of August 4, 1890, when some drunk miners started shooting up the town. As the two officers approached, the pistol-packing partiers opened up on the two lawmen. Gravis fell dead, and the deputy took a bullet but lived. The mine closed in 1942. In addition to the ghost town's ruins, check out the small museum at the Shafter Cemetery. In 1848, San Antonio businessmen commissioned former Ranger Captain Jack Hayes to find a trade route to Chihuahua City, Mexico. Joined by a company of Rangers, Hayes led the expedition to the Big Bend. 50 days later, out of food and water, they reached Presidio. The trailblazing Rangers recuperated at Ben Leeton's private fort before heading home. The old adobe has been restored as Fort Leeton State Historic Site, FM 170 East, Presidio. Wide spot in the road. The El Paso killing of John Wesley Hardin, a Methodist preacher's son who became the Old West's most prolific gunslinger, did not involve directly the Rangers, but none of the lawmen grieved his passing. Released in 1894 after serving time for former Ranger Charles Webb's murder in 1874, Hardin drifted west to El Paso. He had studied law in Stir, but time behind bars had not broken him of boozing, gambling, or a mean disposition. On August 19, 1895, at the Acme Saloon, Constable John Selman ended Hardin's career with 345 slugs. A historical marker at 227 East San Antonio Avenue stands at the site of the old saloon. The outlaw is buried in the city's historic Concordia Cemetery, 3700 East Yandell Drive. At least four former Rangers eternally stand guard over Hardin at the cemetery. Captain Pat Dolan, Ernest St. Leon, who died August 31, 1898, in a line-of-duty shooting downriver from El Paso at Socorro, Carl Kirshner, and Robert Jefferson Carr. Good Eats and Sleeps. Grub. Miss Hattie's Restaurant, San Angelo. Mi Casita, Fort Stockton. Riata Restaurant, Alpine. Fort Davis Drugstore, Fort Davis. The Bean Cafe, Presidio. Hotel El Capitan, Van Horn. L&J Cafe, El Paso. Lodging. Holland Hotel, Alpine. Limpia Hotel, Fort Davis. Hotel Paisano, Marfa. Hotel El Capitan, Van Horn. Hotel Paso del Norte, El Paso. El Paso. Your Ranger-related history tour ends in El Paso, where more Rangers or former Rangers died violently than anywhere else. El Paso has numerous museums, but for an overview of the city's history, start with the El Paso Museum of History, 510 North Santa Fe Street. The Rangers' first trouble in El Paso came in 1877 during the Salt War, a legal dispute over salt deposits east of El Paso. Before it ended, a dozen people, including two Rangers, were dead. A historical marker in the old downriver town of San Elizario summarizes the war. Nearby is the Los Portales Museum and Visitors Center, 1521 San Elizario Road, and Old El Paso County Jail Museum, 1551 Main Street. Ranger Sergeant Charles Fusselman and former Ranger George Harold joined a local rancher on April 17, 1890, in search of rustlers who had butchered one of the cattlemen's calves and stolen some horses. With Fusselman riding ahead, they easily cut the rustler's trail, which led into the Franklin Mountains. That afternoon, Fusselman found the outlaw's hastily vacated camp. As the sergeant looked around, a rifle bullet from the rocky ridge above zinged past his head. Yelling a warning, Fusselman began firing at the ambushers. An instant later, the ranger lay dead. Realizing the outlaws had the high ground and good cover, Harold and the rancher hurried back to El Paso for help. A larger posse rode to the canyon and recovered Fusselman's body and most of the stolen horses, but the outlaws escaped. 10 years later, after Rangers finally caught up with him, Triggerman Geronimo Parra hanged for the murder. A historical marker telling how Fusselman Canyon got its name stands off Woodrow Bean Trans Mountain Road, South Highway 375, 2.5 miles west of U.S. 54. On April 6, 1894, Ranger Joe McKirtrick heard a pistol shot, followed by a police whistle coming from the red light district. Running to Miss Tilly's parlor, he found former Ranger Baz Outlaw drunk and waving a pistol. When the Ranger asked his former colleague to surrender his weapon, Outlaw shot and killed him. Outlaw also got out a round that barely missed Constable John Selman. At that, the constable mortally wounded Outlaw. Still, Outlaw got off two more shots, wounding Selman. The constable recovered. Outlaw did not. Miss Tilly's parlor stood at 307 South Mesa Street. Outlaw's grave is in El Paso's Evergreen Cemetery, 4301 Alameda Avenue. Captain Jones, four Rangers, and a deputy sheriff headed downriver on June 29, 1893 for Pirates Island, an international no man's land caused years before when the Rio Grande changed course. The Rangers carried arrest warrants for two brothers, well-known cattle thieves. They also hoped to locate another brother, a prison escapee. Finding only the wanted men's blind father at home, the Rangers pulled back and made camp. The next morning, they spotted two suspicious horsemen and gave chase, riding straight into an ambush. When the intense firefight ended, the 36-year-old captain was dead. Substantially outnumbered, the Rangers withdrew, leaving Jones's body behind for the time being. A historical marker summarizing the fight stands at 8461 Alameda Avenue in Ysleta. Jones's grave has been lost, his remains believed to have been swept away by the Rio Grande. True West, May 2021 edition. The Man with No Nose by Bob Bowes Bell. Doc Holliday versus Mike Gordon. Quote, Hoodoo Brown's court invents excusable homicide. Gambler draws a pair of sixes and is froze out. By Bob Bowes Bell. Based on the research of Gary L. Roberts. July 19, 1879. Mike Gordon has been on a multi-day binge drunk when he comes into the Holiday Saloon on Center Street, Las Vegas, New Mexico Territory, and demands that his mistress accompany him to another saloon on Railroad Street. She refuses because she is working, so he makes threats and leaves, allegedly swearing he will kill someone or be killed himself before morning. He gets his wish. The Las Vegas Gazette picks up the story. Gordon was standing in the street to the right of the hall after some of his threats and drew a revolver and fired, the bullet passing the pants of a Mexican and struck in the floor in line with the bartender who was standing at the rear of the bar. Other shots were fired immediately, but it is difficult to tell how or by whom. It is said that Gordon fired a second shot. Every person there says three shots were fired, while several maintain that five in all were fired. According to Bat Masterson, who later told the story to a reporter in 1886, Gordon fired a shot from the sidewalk that whizzed a couple of inches from Doc's head and went crashing through a window at the rear of the room. Doc drew his gun and rushed to the front door and saw Gordon standing on the sidewalk with a revolver in his hand. Gordon raised his revolver to fire a second time, but before he could pull the trigger, Doc had shot him dead. Well, not quite. According to the Gazette, the good doctor's shot hit Gordon in the right breast just below the collarbone and exiting below the shoulder blade. Then we get this. Gordon at once ceased firing and disappeared. An hour or two later, a Mr. Kennedy went into his tent some 30 or 40 yards away to go to bed, and hearing groans, investigated and found Gordon laying on the ground outside. The news soon spread, and his woman arriving on the ground had taken him to her room east of the courthouse, where he died at 6 o'clock Sunday morning. In the afternoon, the coroner held an inquest, and the jury returned a verdict of excusable homicide. No charges were fired against the local well-liked Holiday. His name is not even mentioned in any of the accounts, and the coroner's jury apparently believed Gordon got what he deserved. Hoodoo Justice. The coroner for the dead Gordon was Hyman G. Neal, known as Hoodoo Brown, who was the big boss of East Las Vegas, also known as Newtown. He was also the justice of the peace and the leader of the Dodge City Gang. Besides Holiday, the group included mysterious Dave Mather, Dave Rudabaugh, Frank Cady, John Bullshit Jack Pierce, William P. Slapjack Bill Nicholson, and Joe Carson, among others. Doc's partner in the saloon was Jordan Webb, a known associate of Hoodoo Brown. Nobody followed up on the murder. The fix was in. Aftermath, odds and ends. In September of 1879, Wyatt Earp showed up in Las Vegas with a young woman named Maddie Blaylock, his brother Jim, and his family. After spending a month in Newtown, the Earps and Doc, along with his live-in girlfriend Kate Elder, traveled by wagon to the boomtown of Prescott, Arizona territory. When the Earps moved on to Tombstone, Holiday remained for another several months, even returning to Las Vegas at one point to settle accounts. When Holiday returned to Prescott from New Mexico, he ended up rooming on Montezuma Street with the acting governor of Arizona, John J. Gosper. Doc finally arrived in Tombstone in September of 1880 and was soon swept up in the Earps' troubles with the Cowboys, which culminated with the shootout behind the OK Corral on October 26, 1881. Doc rode with Wyatt on his so-called vendetta ride and left the state a fugitive in April of 1882. The Las Vegas Optic, on July 20, 1881, reported, "It will be remembered, especially by the pioneers of the East Side, that Doc Holliday was at one time the keeper of a gin mill on Center Street, near the present site of the Center Street Bakery. Doc was always considered a shiftless, bagged-legged character, a killer and a professional cutthroat, and not a whit too refined to rob stages or even steal sheep. He is the identical individual who killed poor, inoffensive Mike Gordon and crept through one of the many legal loopholes that characterized Hoodoo Brown's judicial dispensation." Doc landed in Colorado, where he spent time in Denver, Pueblo, and Leadville, where he got into another shooting scrape, and finally cashed in his chips at the Glenwood Springs Hotel in Glenwood Springs on November 8, 1887. Recommended: The Life and Legend of Doc Holliday by Gary L. Roberts, John Wiley & Sons, Incorporated, 2006.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.